Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For a long time now, the top perch in American short story writing has been in the pages of the New Yorker magazine. In the 1970s, as the boomers stumbled out of the 60s, Ann Beattie owned that perch. She wrote and wrote on life and her generation, and she's still writing. This hour, On Point, short story great Ann Beattie, and you can join the conversation. What's your question all these years on for the one and only Ann Beattie on life, on fiction, on the arc of the boomers? And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Ann Beattie joins us now from Miami, just up the causeway from Key West, where she spends half of every year now. She's won all the top honors in American short fiction. Her new collection is The New Yorker Stories. It's high on the New York Times top 10 books list for 2010, and many others. Ann Beattie, it's an honor to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Just great to have you. And you're still at it. This goes all the way from the very earliest, right back in the heart of the 1970s, up to the latest 2006. Are you still cranking them out as you did in the 70s, Ann?
Not as many. Also, it goes all the way back to handwriting, manual typewriters,
right,
and now to my daily frustration with PCs.
Right. Take us back to that breakthrough you had in the 1970s and how that happened. You became really the short story writer in a decade where people paid a lot of attention to short stories, but it wasn't exactly a snap of the fingers that did it. How did that happen, Ann?
I was in graduate school at the University of Connecticut, and in fact, I wasn't taking courses any longer, but I was managing to get a few $1,000s a year for teaching freshman comp, which mm-hmm. wasn't too demanding, mm-hmm. and it gave me my nights, and it gave me a lot of my days to work on short stories. And I lived in a house with a lot of other people, and we all had what looked like pretty esoteric interests in those days. One of the guys was a trapper. Another became a burglar. So, mm-hmm. you know, it was the 70s. It was mm-hmm. that time, and I was very young, and I was trying to find out what I could do with writing, and it seemed that the short story was somehow easier for me to tap into initially than a novel, or certainly to this day I write no poetry.
And what did it take to get that embraced by the New Yorker? You had story after story there in the 1970s.
Yeah.
How did that relationship come to be?
Well, I must say, they pulled me out of the slush pile, the unsolicited manuscripts, right away. It was a woman named Fran Kiernan, who has published some wonderful books of her own and who still does things in publishing, who brought my stories to Roger Angel's attention. Roger was then the senior fiction editor of The New Yorker. And so although I didn't realize what a great thing it was to be rejected, it was Roger who first sent me a letter saying, this doesn't work out for us, but it's of interest, and please contact me directly in the future.
And from there, how many times did you submit to them before you were in the magazine and off and running?
Apparently 17. When Ben Yagoda was recently researching a book about the New Yorker, he went to the New York Public Library. I used to make it sound even worse. I said it was 22, but he swears to me it was only 17.
And you were.
But, you know, I didn't know any other writers then. I didn't have any way to compare. I didn't know, although maybe anybody would, that 17 rejections was something that might discourage a person.
Right.
I was exploring. I was learning how to write. And I did have personal contact with the fiction editor of The New Yorker. So in a way, it was very bolstering, although I didn't know what I was up against or what might happen, really.
I've been reading back through this big, wonderful new collection, back to the stories from 74 and 75 and right on through Platonic Relationship and Fancy Flights and Wolf Dreams and Snake Shoes and Vermont. I mean, just story after story here, and trying to picture exactly how you were looking out on your contemporaries as you brought them into fiction, these characters into fiction. I mean, this was a time when, you know, you've got all the trappings of the 70s in there. People seem to be rolling joints every other second, and they're always, you know, griping about Richard Nixon. And I'm thinking, trying to get a bead on where you're coming here. I mean, there's a sort of judgmental, you are judging this, all this stuff for recreational drugs and divorce and, I don't know, fat fecklessness. But you're sort of a hip observer. You seem to have kind of old values. I don't know, not damning, but damned worried about what you were seeing. How would you describe it, Anne, how you were looking at it?
Well, I don't know so much that the writer is judging as making a judgment inherently in terms of the material that is selected. And at least in my case, and I think it's true of a number of writers, you know, you select something that worries you on some level, that that you don't feel like you already have figured out and that you could talk to your friend about if you were having a conversation. The things that are a little more vague than that, the things that are a little more complicated than that, that you maybe empathize with or have curiosity about, and yet it isn't directly your life. I didn't spend my entire life smoking joints. Mm-hmm. I still could be goaded into complaining bitterly and for a long time about Richard Nixon, but that's neither here nor there. You know, I was in that milieu. That was the world I moved in.
Maybe the best way is to just hear it. I think there's a little passage from Fancy Flights, which goes back
yes.
to 74, and this is one of your earliest works in The New Yorker. October 1974, main character is a man named Michael. He's separated from his wife. Everybody seems separated or divorced or relationships falling apart from his wife, Elsa. And he just seems to grow more and more interested in smoking marijuana all day, more than holding down a job or caring for his daughter, Marianne. There's a little passage that kind of captures that. I wonder if you could read for us, Anne.
Yes. Michael looks at his daughter and her friend enjoying their tea party. He goes into the bathroom and takes his pipe off the window ledge, closes the door, and opens the window and lights it. He sits on the bathroom floor with his legs crossed, listening to the woman weeping on television. He notices Marianne's bunny. Its eyebrows are raised with amazement at him. It is ridiculous to be sitting in the bathroom getting stoned while a tea party is going on and a woman shrieks in the background. "What else can I do?" he whispers to the bunny. He envies the bunny, the way it clutches the bar of soap to its chest. When he hears Elsa come in, he leaves the bathroom and goes into the hall and puts his arms around her, thinking about the bunny and the soap. Mick Jagger sings to him, "All the dreams we held so close seem to all go up in smoke." "Elsa," he says, "what are your dreams?" "That your dealer will die," she says. "He won't. He's only 20 years old."
And B.D., reading from her October 1974 short story, Fancy Flights. I mean, what is up with these people, Anne? You're just maybe a kind of a decade ahead of me here. And nevertheless, I mean, the people here seem so ineffectual, so lost. Is that what you saw around you in 1974?
I guess I frankly don't see it as being as exceptional. Maybe that is, of course, because, again, that was the world I lived in. But, again, my interest as a writer in terms of looking at these things, ultimately I do think that these people are somewhat lost, but it's not a problem-solving situation, really, when I'm writing. It's more to maybe articulate something or find a way to present these people that, even to me, is a little bit more comprehensible than their physical passivity. In other words, the stories may themselves have a kind of laconic feel to mm-hmm. them. They may elapse in a different way than a lot of plot-driven short stories. But my interest has always been to come in close on something and to hope that the tone and the details will determine a different impression if we look at something closely.
Oh, yeah, clearly not problem solving, but very, very closely observing. And, you know, your subject that you've chosen, as you've chosen to put it here, is sitting in the bathroom, you know, smoking a joint or a pipe and staring at a bunny. Was that your broader impression of your cohort at that time?
Yeah. Well, I still have a lot of funny things around my house. It's very interesting because in the 70s, and this is something I teach at the University of Virginia, mm-hmm. and I often have to back up and explain
right. what was happening,
things.
Right?
Yeah, what's happening, yeah. I do, but I have to, it's very amusing, and often I, like everyone else, assume that everybody knows the same world I know, and that's clearly not true of 21-year-old students.
What do you tell 21-year-olds then about this time that you are putting so potently on the page?
I don't discuss my own work, so I can dodge that very easily. But what I say about the stories you know, short stories themselves, and I'll include mine in that, is that you have to think why it's this way and not another way. I don't mean in terms of the plot of the story. I mean, you have to think, why did the writer make the decisions to, for example, write a very claustrophobic story like Fancy Flights? Fancy Flights takes place in New England. It is a guy who's already at a very young age separated from his wife. He has the responsibility for a daughter, but his greatest friend is his dog. That doesn't seem unusual to me. I don't suspect that that's extremely unusual even now. But tracking him in the way that I tracked him, not letting him off the hook, in the 70s was much more unusual than what you'll find in short stories now.
You've written many more since then. I guess every author comes into their time and looks around and sees what they see. Do you consider it a, I don't know, a blessing, a curse, something in between, that that your meat has been the generation around you, the baby boomers?
Well, it worked for me, I have to say. And I mean, it worked for me in the sense of engaging my interest very much. You know, I there were other parts of the culture to look at that never interested me to look at, but I looked at that part of the culture. And I have to say that when I did start publishing in The New Yorker, on the surface, it would have seemed like a very unlikely place to be printing stories like Fancy Flights, the one I just read from. I mean, socioeconomically, in terms of characters sitting around all day smoking dope, those are all reductive ways to characterize my stories, but nevertheless, those are, you know, things that are representative of elements in my stories. And The New Yorker, I don't think in people's minds to this point would have been the first publication to step forward for something like this.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with short story writing great Ann Beattie about her life and her generation in short fiction. Her big new collection is The New Yorker Stories, 48 over decades of her writing for The New Yorker magazine. She's up from Key West for us today. It wasn't all short stories. Ann Beattie's first novel, Chilly Scenes of Winter, was made into a movie in 1979. In the novel and the film, a man named Charles, played by John Hurd here, seeks to rekindle an affair with former lover Laura, played by Mary Beth Hurt. In this scene from early in the film, Charles' glasses are wet with snow when he gets into a car, and he remembers a conversation he had with Laura.
Give me your glasses.
Come and get them.
Hey, what's going on under there, huh?
Not much.
I'm wet too. Can you drive me off the same way?
Don't you wish. You still haven't gotten these fixed.
Anything to wear in the meantime?
They can fix them while you wait.
They can?
Sure.
How do you know things like that?
How do you not know things like that?
I need you to come live with me to tell me things like that.
From Chilly Scenes of Winter, from Ann Beattie's first novel. And here's a Facebook comment from Michael saying, Chilly Scenes of Winter, one of my favorite novels of all time. How do you look back? You may not talk about your work with your students, but when you look at your generation, some of the people who came along as writers in your time, maybe in your shoes, Anne, what were you doing that was new, that was different than the folks you grew up reading and admiring? I mean, you trace your own sort of line back, maybe Hemingway and Beckett and Pinter, I don't know, and favorites Flaubert and Joyce, Elizabeth Bishop. What were you doing that was new?
I think a lot of it depended on the tone. I don't know that I really was doing anything that was radical. I look at Chilly Scenes of Winter, and it seems to me on some level to be about yearning. No time period for that. It seems to be about characters who are young, and therefore the mixed audience who's going to be reading about them or seeing the movie or whatever is going to have a different perspective on a lot of what's happening. And the writer's always aware of that when putting something out there. But for me, looking back, I would say that, number one, maybe I was rather lucky that there just didn't happen to be a great deal of competition at that time. I didn't see people my age, you know, publishing a lot of books in those days. I think I was 26 when Chilly Scenes of Winter came out, and it came out at the same time that my first short story collection, Distortions, came out. So they were published on the same day and that sort of thing. I don't know, fast out of the gate. Nothing to be said about that except that that was coincidence and that that was the way it worked for me. But if anything, I would think it's the tone of the stories and the fact that there is a bemused quality that the writer has and a kind of, again, backed off way of working almost cinematically and letting these things evolve and speak for themselves.
Did you come to think of yourself as part of, I don't know, a class or generation of writers? If you look at, I don't know, Raymond Carver or Mary Robeson, Bobby Ann Mason, do you think of those as your gang or something else?
All very good writers. No, I certainly don't think of them as my gang. I didn't even know them. So mostly I think of my gang as people I go back many, many years with. No, those were not the people that I was seeing ever on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. I met Raymond Carver in 1980 or 81 in New York City, although his first book, Will You Please Be Quiet, Please, mm-hmm. Was published in 1976, which was the same time my book Distortions came out. I certainly can see that here and there in the cosmos, writers had things in common, and I think somewhat we did, even though we wrote very differently. We were very different voices. I greatly admire Raymond Carver and always did, for example. But no, I didn't feel, in other words, that that we were a group, no.
Ann Beattie's new collection is The New Yorker Stories. It's getting rave reviews, many decades represented here. Agafa joins us right now from Storrs, Connecticut, your old stomping grounds, Ann. Agafa, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Ann.
Hi.
The last time I saw you, we were standing together at a bus stop in front of Bev's, the old bus stop in downtown Willimantic. I was envious of you because I said, we had just read together at UConn, and I said, well, I'm envious because your career is going somewhere and mine, my writing career doesn't seem to be. And you said to me, well, Agatha, I just had a new baby, Caroline, who's now 30. Yeah. And you said, well, Agatha, my career is going somewhere, but you've got the baby. Do you remember that little example, that little incident?
Well, to be honest, no.
How could you?
It sounds entirely true, though, I must say,
yeah,
Agatha.
Well, we had just read together at UConn.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I've stayed in, well, I haven't really stayed in Storrs completely because I've been to 150 countries, so it's not as if I've just stayed around here.
Agatha, have you stayed?
Well, good for you.
Have you stayed?
You've got the 150 countries and I don't.
The baby and the half the world, more than that. Agatha, have you kept reading, Ann Beattie? What she meant to you?
Absolutely. No, and once she was down at a bookstore along the coast, and I thought, oh, man, I'm going to make it down there. So I took off down there to her reading, and, of course, I had a flat tire on the way and didn't make it. But I've sort of kept in touch vicariously by reading her books.
It's great. Agafa, I appreciate your call. Thank you very much. And one more from Connecticut. West Hartford, Nada, you're on the air with Ann Beattie.
Yes, my big question is, Ann, I'm embarrassed I don't know your writing, but I've just begun. I'm 67. Publishing, and my God, I would never have thought to go to The New Yorker. Any advice for me? I only have 20 years left in my life, I figure, to publish.
67 or 21, what do you tell your you know, those who come to you with that question these days, Ann, for where to go to be published?
I, you know, really can't answer that question unless I know the person's writing, and then I can sometimes suggest individual publications that might be receptive to it or something like that. I could suggest the obvious, which would be to somehow join a community of other writers, whether it be in a book group or whether it be perhaps attending some summer writers' conference. You make contacts in ways like that. I think more than I'm aware of, there is quite a dialogue going on electronically that you can join in with, and that a lot of people are hoping to share their experiences with you or find out more things. I think there are a lot of ways you can tap into things, but, you know, they're so, I mean, I have had the same agent since 1976. I'm so thankful that I have. But, you know, I don't really therefore know the field. I don't really keep up. I don't, I'm not exactly looking for the same things in the same way that I understand a lot of writers are.
And what's your sense of the whole American appetite for short stories these days? I mean,
I think it's great.
So what's most lively? Do you see as many readers, as avid readers today of short fiction as you saw when you were in the in the thick of the 1970s version of it?
Many, many more. In the 1970s, for example, when Gordon Lish was the fiction editor of Esquire magazine and was publishing for the first time writers like Raymond Carver or Don DeLillo, Joy Williams, I mean, fabulous, fabulous writers, there it was. It was in that little place. And certainly The New Yorker also published extremely wonderful writers. But it was the mandate that, that Gordon Lish had that he was supposed to find new voices. And Barry Hanna, wonderful writers, he did find these new voices. And so people I knew read and talked about Esquire in those days. And similarly, people read and talk about The New Yorker now. They also read and talk about a wonderful online magazine called Narrative. I think people who want to know about the short story, who are very interested in it, find those places and find those touchstones. To me now, because so many magazines in particular are not publishing as much fiction, if they're publishing any fiction. Many, many have stepped away from it. Actually, in terms of magazines, the field is much more closed down from when I began.
And is there a kind of ringmaster like Gordon Lish was in those days? I knew Gordon a little in those years. Is there anybody like that now?
I think there are individual editors at book publishing houses that are a little bit that way now. I think there are certainly editors that get a great deal of respect now, but I'm not quite sure because, you know, what Gordon set out to do worked. In other words, people did start looking at what was being written right that minute, and it was writing of a very vivid sort with very distinctive voices. And even if maybe some of them were not in The New Yorker quite as often as I was, and that, of course, called great attention to me because The New Yorker was a weekly magazine, nonetheless, people hung in there. People who were interested in those writers, you know, would read interviews with those writers and find out what writers they liked, and it grew.
Let's go to Salt Lake City, Utah. And Miriam, Miriam, you're on the air with Ann Beattie.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Ann.
Hello.
Some time ago you had a show about books that you had to read. You had some authors on.
Mm-hmm.
And I called in and said, you know, I was having a big medical year and I just couldn't get through novels. And one of your guests suggested some short story writers, including Anne.
I remember, Miriam. How'd that go?
Well, okay, this year I've had 3 surgeries and 2 other procedures, all on my hip.
And is Ann Beattie helping you get through that travail?
Yes. I think until I'm finally off all my painkillers and other medications, I'm going to have a hard time reading. And having short stories has been just salvation for me.
And what about Ann Beattie's in particular? What do you make of them, Miriam?
Don't ask me about a particular story because my memory is not great.
Mm-hmm.
But I just... they've been good. They've really been great. I've only read a couple, and I'm looking forward to reading more. I just recently got a list of other books and things that you've written, so I'm going to be going through them.
Well, the New Yorker stories, I tell you, will keep you busy for many hours, and we wish you luck, Miriam, and I appreciate your call a lot. Let me get one more. Brunswick, Georgia. Bob, you're on the air with Ann Beattie.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
Yes.
I was just going to ask about, this is the second story I've heard on short stories. I've never even heard Chekhov's name mentioned. He just seemed to be so superior in his simple, so profound writing in such a simple manner, you know. I'm not intelligent enough to read Beckett or Virginia Woolf, but boy, he sure hit home with me. What did you think about, Chekhov?
What do you say, Ann?
Believe me, if you can read Chekhov, you could read those other writers. Believe me, don't be put off by what you think is true of them. You know, they are writers who are alluded to, who are referred to so very often in so many contemporary writers' work. If you think you can't read Virginia Woolf, at least give Michael Cunningham's The Hours a try and read in reverse order. The book is built upon Virginia Woolf's wonderful novel. There are ways in, and please don't be put off. The way some of this was summarized to us years ago, made it seem very unapproachable, but I don't think it is at all. I think readers have become more open, not just more sophisticated, but really more open, and that these are very accessible texts. My personal, what I have to say about Chekhov, a number of years ago, there was a wonderful collection put out of, I think it was the Selected Chekhov, it may have been the Collected, and Richard Ford, who is himself a fabulous writer and a particularly wonderful short story writer, too, wrote the introduction to that, and I really recommend that to you.
And take us further in your arc here. We had Fancy Flights from 74. You've got Where You'll Find Me, one of your very well-known short stories. 1986, it appeared in the New Yorker, referenced there in the title to the Judy Garland song, Somewhere Over the Rainbow, of course.
Mm-hmm.
A title of one of your collections. But this is a story where a New York City woman is, reluctantly traveled up to Saratoga for a Christmas at her brother Howard's house. They go out to 7-Eleven to get ice. They're revealing to each other about desires for secret affairs that never quite took shape. Could you read a bit from that for us, Anne?
Yes. Almost to the end of the story. Back at the house, as Howard goes in front of me up the flagstone pathway, I walk slower than I usually do in the cold, trying to give myself time to puzzle out what he makes me think of just then. It comes to me at the moment when my attention is diverted by a patch of ice I'm terrified of slipping on. He reminds me of that courthouse figure. I don't know what it's called. The statue of a blindfolded woman holding the scales of justice. Bag of ice in the left hand, bag of ice in the right, but there's no blindfold. The door is suddenly opened, and what Howard and I see before us is Koenig, his customary bandana tied around his head, smiling welcome, and behind him, in the glare of the already begun party, the woman with red hair holding Todd, who clutches his green dinosaur in one hand and rubs his sleepy, crying face with the other. Todd makes a lunge, not really toward his father, but toward wider spaces, and I'm conscious all at once of the cigarette smoke swirling and the heat of the house there in the entranceway that turn the bitter cold outdoor air silver as it comes flooding in. Messiah, Kate's choice of perfect music for the occasion, isn't playing. Someone has put on Judy Garland, and we walk in just as she is singing, "That's Where You'll Find Me." The words hang in the air like smoke.
And Beatty, reading from Where You'll Find Me, 1986. Commitment and its absence, big themes early on in your work and throughout with this generation. Do you see, commitment throughout history is a big deal for human beings, but do the boomers have a different distinctive problem with it?
I'm sorry, distinctive problem with what?
Commitment in relationships.
Commitment?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the divorce rate doesn't begin or end with the boomers, certainly.
Okay.
The society seemed very open up in the 60s. It seemed very open in terms of possibility. And I think all of us have seen that even when things did materialize, a lot of them were more slow in coming than we thought. We had to come up with, different approaches ourselves to try to continue to get social change, to get some of the things that were important to us. And, that integrating that's a hard life lesson. It doesn't happen overnight. It doesn't happen the first time you set out on a march that doesn't result in anything instantly. The newspaper underreports the numbers, all of that. I think it's a gradual process always for any generation, not just the baby boomers, about where they do belong in their society and how much freedom they can take, how much they aspire to, and how much really is there that they can explore.
I think
it's a more personal problem.
Absolutely. We'll come back and look at that and more. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour with short story writing great Anne Beatty about her life and her generation in short fiction. Her big new collection is The New Yorker Stories, all the way from 1974 right up into this decade. Anne, I was thinking as I read through here, all this kind of lost quality. You were just describing a sort of a mission-driven generation in the boomers, and certainly there was that.
But there was a lot of ennui in your pages as well, and I found myself thinking, is it any wonder that this is a generation that suddenly also had the, you know, revival of evangelical religion and all the rest? I mean, when you get that sort of strung out and lost sounding, at least as I read this generation in the lines of your short stories, Anne, it seems like something's going to happen. Maybe that was part of what happened in response.
Well, I notice a lot of things about the short stories. If you notice, very few people go to work. It's not just that they are going to work and performing their jobs badly, but if they have work, they work at an axe handle factory, you know, and get back to their dog as fast as they can or something like that. So, again, I'm writing more often about people who have already found some way to live on the margins. I mean, in my personal opinion, it gets harder and harder to live in the United States, period. We all know that. The top 1% have more of the wealth than all of the bottom 50% put together. That's a pretty shocking statistic.
Mm-hmm.
And yet when I look at my personal friends trying to make a way and function in this economy, I see the same thing now to an extent that I saw then, which is not exactly – it would overstate it to say that people are going underground, but people are sort of regrouping and trying to find ways to do as best they can on the margins.
Michael Kinsley's writing last month or in October in the Atlantic magazine saying it's time for the boomers to step up and, you know, do one last big thing before they begin to stride off. He said the boomers ought to step up, sort of pull out the resources and pay off the national debt. How do you think about how the boomers have performed? Tom Brokaw celebrated the greatest generation. What about the boomers?
I think if somebody more important than me, I think if Jon Stewart and Colbert want to, you know, broadcast that information to the boomers and see if they can really get something going, that might be a little bit more likely than whatever my opinions are.
Well, we'll see. Karen in Somerset, Kentucky, you're on with Ann Beattie. Karen.
Well, I really had the same question. Hi, thank you. Why the baby boomers are so quiet right now when it really seems to me that the whole Social Security thing is aimed at us. That we're going to be, I want to say screwed. I don't know if I can say that, but why the baby boomers are so quiet when we did it all in the 60s and 70s? Women, anti-war, this war in Afghanistan and Iraq. What is going on?
There's a broad one, Anne. But I put a similar question to Patti Smith recently. She was on with her new book about her relationship with Robert Mapplethorpe, and I think people sort of want some folks of stature from the boomer generation to speak up and respond to that kind of question. Is there a generational responsibility here? Was there something that didn't go right in the approach? Was there something bigger about the American system that overwhelmed the boomers? I don't know, Anne.
I mean, there are many things I could say just anecdotally. I'm not a social critic. I'm certainly not a philosopher. It seems to me that the amount of information overload that all of us, not just the boomers, are functioning with, it's often extremely hard to figure out exactly what the truth of a lot of issues is and who to approach and how to make that approach when everything is very diffuse now. I don't think we live in communities the same way we used to. I used to live in a house with a bunch of other people.
Mm-hmm.
There are still such houses in the United States, group houses and so forth. But more and more, I think that people are being overwhelmed by confusion paired with the fact that, for example, the baby boomers have suddenly inherited the problem of caring for their parents. Everybody's living longer now. It's a different kind of obligation. It's a full-time obligation. So on the personal level, and they're, you know, getting your kids into college, what it is compared to when I wrote a couple of letters probably in handwriting and applied to colleges versus the almost crazy overthinking millions of letters of recommendations, you know, all that sort of thing. In other words, I think personally speaking, even though I don't have children and I'm not fighting this, I know it's going on. I did have parents, and it certainly was a complicating factor in my life to try to look after them as best I could in recent years. I'm an only child.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, people have a lot on their plate, and it seems like there's such bitterness among the politicians. It's just very hard to convince yourself that if the president can't do much about that in any way, you know, maybe in smaller ways, yes, we should unite more and we should certainly not stop fighting the good fight. But I'm not quite sure that anybody is convinced anymore with the acrimonious relationship between the Democrats and the Republicans that another march on Washington is going to turn the tide.
Let's get a call from New York City. Tony, you're on the air with Ann. Thanks for calling, Tony.
Hi, Ann. I recently retired as a college English a college English teacher, and I wanted to say that one or two stories are especially significant in getting young people into the way literature works. I think of the story Shifting that you published some time ago, a long time ago actually, and how since you're talking about ennui and the kids really relate to it, the purposelessness of the heroine who's languishing in a bad marriage, and her attraction to the Volvo, learning how to drive as a way to get her life underway again is a perfect perfect analogy to how we can revive ourselves and get out of the doldrums.
And this is a story from 1977, Tony, and you have found your students much more recently relating to what they read there in Shifting?
Absolutely, and the plight of many of the students in her stories, the lack of purpose especially, and the problems of relating to the adult world and engaging in a meaningful life. These are vital issues right now. Many kids are getting out of college and they're really bewildered, in my estimation.
Yes.
Tony, thanks for that. And you deal with students of just that age, 21-year-olds, as you say, 20-year-olds. How do you find them compared to those you wrote about, you know, nearly four decades ago now?
I find them wanting to go out and do something meaningful. I find them wanting to function as individuals and thinking that things are still possible. Of course, they realize there are grim economic truths, but one way or another, I've just seen so many people who have embarked on one thing or another, whether they've been an unpaid intern, and it's wonderful then if, you know, their parents can afford to bankroll that for a period or whatever. It's always understood that money is an important factor, but my students aren't after that per se. They're just trying to have enough to get by so that they can take a stand and try to do something for change. They're terrific.
Randy, in Augusta, Georgia, you're on with Ann Beattie.
I have not read any of your books, but after listening today, I can't wait to get a hold of the New York Times copy. Is that how we get a list of all your stories?
It was in the Sunday New York Times Book Review as one of the 10 best books of the year, yes.
But that, okay, because I really would like to read them. And I recently read something by Elizabeth Strout. Are you familiar with her? She just
yes, I am.
Started writing.
Mm-hmm. Olive Kittredge?
Yeah, Olive Kittredge.
Olive Kittredge. Mm-hmm. And that turned me on to short stories. Because
well, terrific, whatever does.
Pardon me?
Terrific, whatever does.
Well, I was a first grade teacher for 15 years and then remedial reading, and I felt that if the children couldn't do math, they could use all these machines, but if they couldn't read, they couldn't do anything. So I'm delighted that I now have time to read all your stories, and it's a special gift to me to have this for the holiday season, and I can stay home and read your books and enjoy them.
Thank you, Randy. That's
thank
great.
You.
Thank you very much. And you've often been spoken of as a minimalist writer, and I've seen you sort of push back against that. There's the company of, you know, Tobias Wolff and Mary Robeson, Raymond Carver, those around you. I mean, is it a label brand you wear with pride? Do you push it away? If so, why?
Maybe I could have a complete change in my life if I embraced minimalism. Tell me, what would I do to embrace minimalism? How would this make things better for me?
It might mean nothing at all, but I found it interesting that you don't describe yourself as in that particular style? I mean, is it just
none
confining?
None of those writers you mentioned do. Not one of them. Toby Wolfe would not describe himself as a minimalist. Or Raymond Carver wrote eloquently on the subject about, in effect, there being no such thing as minimalism. And I am not quite so sure about speaking for Mary Robeson. Mm-hmm. I would highly doubt that that's how she categorizes herself. You know, Carver bristled at it because he said it meant it was a lesser version of something. That's what he always heard when people said minimalism. And, you know, the term originated in the visual arts. It was a term for painting. It didn't really make the leap. It didn't really make any sense. It was just an amorphous way of talking about tone and style and a new way of putting together stories, which I do admit existed, but again, not as a movement, not in terms of people who personally knew one another. This was not the fugitive poets taking a stand or something like that.
Right.
And to all of us, I'm afraid what we really heard in minimalism was people I mean, readers don't say that. Critics say that.
Of course. It's one of those terms. But it's not exactly, I mean, it's very often said with admiration. It was sort of carving down to the essence or leaving out what doesn't need to be there, knowing that readers will imagine it anyway if you've structured right.
Sure, but that's no different than Chekhov. We were talking about Chekhov a moment before. I mean, so much of Chekhov is between the lines and off the page. And I think with the realistic writing, that is always the working method. No, I still simply don't understand it. It just isn't anything I can really say anything intelligent about because I've never known what the term was supposed to point anyone in the direction of.
So just read. Bill in Highgate Springs, Vermont. Bill, you're on the air with Ann Beattie.
Yes, hello, Tom, and hello, Ann.
Hello.
Question for you, Ann. I'm a retired broadcast journalist, and about 2 years ago, my first novel, a mystery, was published out of Montreal, and I have a second one coming out in May. I've got a cupboard full of short stories and short story ideas gathering dust, and I wondered, from a structural point of view, is there a very different approach to writing a short story, let's say in terms of the volume of dialogue versus description, first person, third person, that kind of thing?
That's a very hard question to answer with any exactness. You know, what I would say about a short story is that you use language very differently between all the genres. The language that you would use in a poem has a kind of distillation and has an evocative quality that doesn't disappear just because some related language might be in a short story, nor does it even disappear in a novel. It's just that you have to think then more about the connotations of these things and spread out over one page on which you see a poem or, say, 10 pages printed in a book or a novel of many hundred pages. How do you keep that thing viable? How do you guide the reader through the story you want them to read because you really only have your language? So you have to always think differently and think very, very differently within those forms.
Bill, good luck with that. And I wish you'd read us just one more bit. We've been in the 70s with you today, in the 80s. There's a story, Find and Replace, from 2001, which, if there's an arc to boomer life, takes us right into that time when boomers are looking at and after parents, and your narrator has a mother who's lost her father but is right off to another man. There's nothing she can do about it, even though she might like to. I wonder if you could read a little bit of that for us.
My mother seemed less timid now. Obviously, she too could be quite impulsive. I was just about to tap the horn when my mother stood and took a minute to steady herself before heading toward the house. Why was she bent over, walking so slowly? Had she been pretending to be very spry earlier, or had I just not noticed? Then the door opened, and a man, it was Drake, that was who it was, stood on the threshold, extending a hand and waiting, not going down the steps, just waiting. He stood ramrod straight, but even driving slowly, I got only a glimpse of him, this man who was not my father, with his big hand extended, and my mother lifting her hand like a lady ascending an elegant carpeted staircase instead of three concrete steps.
Ann Beattie's story, Find and Replace, from 2001. How do you know these days, Ann, when you've got the thread, when you're onto a new story? Does it come to you when you're sitting at the keyboard or when you're, I don't know, at the supermarket? How do you know?
That would be great. I'd be willing to go grocery shopping more often if
sure.
That was the payoff. I could get into that one, yeah.
Is it random? Does it just come out of the – or do you sit down and put your mind to it, or does it come to you and then you race to the keyboard?
Well, two things have been pointed out to me. Number one, and I don't remember this often enough, if you don't sit down, it's not going to come to you. You know, everything else will intervene, and then you're not doing your writing. And I don't sit down as often as I should these days. But another thing is that, you know, the stories at some point, I know this sounds strange, but they tell themselves to me, or they don't, or I don't get a story. I have three pages of writing and it goes nowhere. But, you know, by putting words in front of words, lines in front of lines, you suddenly realize that you're making some kind of a pattern. You may not know ultimately what that pattern will be, how it will resolve, but the next sentence you put can really open your eyes to something you didn't even know was there. It's really a question of just verbalizing things and their placement.
And Bidi, you've done it again and again, and we are the beneficiaries of that. We're grateful for all the stories over all these years. The new collection is the New Yorker Stories from Ann Beatty, joining us today from Miami. Ann, thank you so much. Good luck. Thanks for being with
us. Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gale Rosen, Ping Wong, Alina Mata, Stefano Katsonis, Hilary McQuilkin, James Ross, Marika Spence, and John Wibby, with help from Mackenzie Knowles-Kirson and Jessica Willingham. Our senior producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.